Okay, for our next talk, I'd like to welcome Johnny Lynn to the program. You may all recognize him as a former council member and a student member and been a good friend. So let's get your...
You were up here, weren't you?
You're up there.
Let's get you... Screen mount.
Okay, Johnny is going to talk to us on environmental problems as a place for compromise and dialogue. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
So a little bit as an introduction. So I'm currently at the University of Washington's Bothell campus in their computer science department. And you may be wondering why computer scientists would be talking about environmental issues. This is kind of like a new career for me. My training is actually as an atmospheric scientist, and so I did climate dynamics for a number of years, but made some transition, and so now I teach programming. And I'm also at North Park University on an affiliate basis in the physics department. Okay, so imagine the following scenario. You're at a town hall meeting, and it's a meeting maybe on land, water use policy for the city that you live in, and each side discounts the arguments of the other and appears suspicious of the motives of the other side. So do you conclude that environmental problems are intrinsically intractable or that they're a great place for compromise and dialogue? Okay. Now, the purpose of my talk is to argue that the second is actually the correct conclusion, or at least it could be the correct conclusion with regards to these particular issues. And my attempt to make an argument for this claim, I'll make these three following sort of sub-arguments. First of all, I'll suggest that there's a prudential element for many environmental problems, and that prudential element actually produces a lot of potential ground for compromise and dialogue that may not appear to be there upon first blush or in many of the conversations and debates that we have. Secondly, I want to argue that there are limitations with regards to what kind of input the science can make into environmental issues, and that these limitations actually have the benefit of providing more ground for dialogue and compromise to occur, which also may not seem to be in line with conventional wisdom. And third, I want to go through a few of some of the models, the collaborative models that have come out of natural resources planning and have come out of other environmental planning type issues and practices that we can draw upon to actually put into effect this type of dialogue potential that I'm suggesting. Okay, so the first argument that I'm making is that environmental issues have this prudential component to them. And in sort of explaining what I mean by that, I want to draw upon a distinction between how within judgments there can be a prudential element to it, or prudential type of judgment, as well as what I'll just call more moral or ethical judgments. The prudential elements I'm listing here on the left column and the right column as contrast what I'm terming more moral components of a judgment. Now, and I'm saying that within judgments, you can have both of these kinds of components. I'm not saying that environmental issues are merely one or the other, nor am I saying that other problems don't have both prudential as well as moral elements. But I am going to make a claim that there is actually a large area within environmental problems that are prudential. So prudential problems, one element about prudential judgments is that they will have a dependence upon context. The context will make a very large role, or play a very large role, in terms of how you answer questions of that nature. Whereas moral judgments, in general, they tend to be very imperative focused. They're focused on duty or that you must do something. Prudential judgments tend to be those characterized by practical wisdom with a limitation by a possible blend of principles. So it's not merely practicality. It's practicality that's limited and informed by principles. In the case of moral judgments, those, though, happen to, generally speaking, they're limited in the sense that the number of cases that a particular moral judgment will apply will be for a certain subset. Its applicability as an analogy might apply to a broader spectrum, but in terms of its direct applicability, it will tend to be limited. Prudential judgments are generally open to multiple strategies, whereas moral judgments, they may be open to multiple strategies or they may be closed to multiple strategies, and it depends upon the nature of the moral principle that's involved. So as an example of how a prudential judgment may sort of play itself out in a specific case with regards to global warming. On the left, so here on this particular table, on the left, I have list a few sort of moral principles that will tend to be discussed with regards to global warming questions. Those principles include ethics of stewardship and care, rights of future generations. So are there things that us as a current generation, we have an obligation for in terms of guaranteeing for generations yet to come? Private property rights are certainly part of that conversation, as well as the intrinsic value of nature. On what basis do we say that nature has value? What's the source of that value, and what kind of value does it have? So on the left, there are some principles that are discussed within the context of global warming responses. Now on the right are some possible responses that have been listed or have been discussed with regards to global warming. A carbon tax to take the externalities that deal with carbon emissions to make those more explicit. Tradable emission credits to enable some sort of functioning market with regards to emissions. Air capture would be the technological removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, not necessarily at the point of generation, but at essentially anywhere that the carbon dioxide exists. And adaptation would be to, for instance, changing zoning laws or the rules that govern flood insurance or building seawalls or things of that variety. The thing that I want to point out is that the items in the left column do not rigidly determine the items in the right column. A number of the moral principles that are listed in the left column are conducive to a number of the responses that are in the right column, and vice versa. That's the point that I want to make about the prudential element within a particular environmental problem, is that because of that prudential space, that prudential element with regards to judgment, then there are actually a number of possible responses that may conduce with the moral principles that we do have and bring to bear upon that problem. As a result, because responses aren't rigidly constrained by moral principles, necessarily so within environmental problems, there's more room for dialogue, or at least the possibility of dialogue exists. The second point I'd like to make is that science may not necessarily prescribe policy. It's certainly plays an important role within policy and our understanding of things, but it's not necessarily something that will prescribe it. So one case where we can see this activity is within the case of the policy responses to stratospheric ozone depletion. This is often cited as a model of science dictating policy, but one of the things that we'll be looking at is that there's work that suggests that model, that storyline, is not quite as nuanced as it could be. So the first argument I would make in this particular point is that science, while it describes the state of nature, it doesn't necessarily fully describe what that state should be. That is to say, science describes what is, so this first bullet here, but if we want to answer the question what should be, we also need to ask what is the meaning of what it is that we see. In philosophical terms, mere existence does not necessarily mean that something has value. There needs to be more that you bring into the conversation. And this is often called fact-value dualism or fact-value distinction. So if it's true that science doesn't determine entirely what should be, then in asking the questions of what kind of responses are appropriate for certain environmental problems, to only look at the science is something that probably isn't going to do everything that we're hoping it to do. We shouldn't be surprised as a result then to find that the way science acts in environmental issues, while in certain cases might be directly, especially in ones that are more global in nature and ones that can have more contentiousness to them, that the action that science plays is actually not necessarily directly. And so one example of this is with regards to the stratospheric ozone problem and the way that the Montreal Protocol was finally developed. It turns out that while conventional wisdom would say that the science discovered the ozone hole and the cause behind it, that is the human generation of chlorofluorocarbons, that after that, policymakers listened to the scientists and they enacted a ban on CFCs, and the result was that the ozone hole was closed. What actually happened, or at least the nuances that go on to that story, and this is work by Daniel Sarewitz and Roger Pilkey Jr. that I'll be describing. First is that political action occurred even while the science was uncertain. And so there wasn't a consensus at the time that political action started happening. The second thing is that the responses that were made, rather than being an all-out ban for chlorofluorocarbons, instead, there was a set of tiered policies that were enacted. And the result of these tiered policies was the stimulation of research into alternatives to CFCs. And so as a result, by the time the Montreal Protocol was actually finalized in its eventual form and a full all-out ban was created, economical alternatives existed that essentially, you know, cut the ground under the kind of contentiousness that would happen from various stakeholders that had differing views. And so those conflicts didn't materialize in the way that might have happened if those alternatives did not exist. Okay. And so if science does not prescribe environmental policy fully, again, I'm not saying that science doesn't have an important role, merely saying that a policy prescriptive model of science, if that's not the only model that exists, the first thing that could result from this is that there's more opportunities for dialogue because there's more that we can talk about. There's more that's actually fair game as part of the discussion. A second thing is that this would also encourage value debates rather than science debates because instead of framing the entire sort of response to an environmental issue within the context of just, well, what does the science say? We now are also able to introduce these value discussions that need to occur. And I would also argue, too, that for a lot of these issues, the fundamental disagreements are actually not ultimately with regards to a specific policy, but they're really ultimately disagreements of a fundamental value nature. And so in thinking of a non-policy prescriptive role for science, there's then a greater opportunity to address root causes rather than to focus entirely on debates over science, for instance. The third argument that I suggest as to why environmental issues may actually be a ground for dialogue and is that it's already happening. There already has been work, and has been work for quite a while, in building up collaborative models that enable there to be productive discussion and compromise around environmental issues that can be contentious. So I'll describe a couple of the things that have been done. The first one concerns an effort that was begun in the Clinton administration. It took around 10 years to do, and it was to create a comprehensive ecosystem development plan for the interior Columbia River Basin. So this basin covers essentially eastern Washington, eastern Oregon, and northern Idaho. As you can imagine, the Columbia River drains a lot of area, and there are a lot of various stakeholders that participate in the use of that particular region. So everything from lumber to environmental concerns to fisheries, as well as agriculture, these are all various stakeholders who do not always agree with one another with regards to how to use the resources. And so when the federal government worked to design this ecosystem management plan, this comprehensive plan, The way science was introduced was to be a neutral meeting ground for these disparate stakeholders to discuss things. And they did it by producing assessments in a value-neutral way as opposed to policy judgments. The result, as some folks from the Forest Service, Mills and Clark, described, is that a forum was created where otherwise polarized interests may engage in productive dialogue and analysis of opinion. That whole effort really required science to kind of step back and pull itself back, really to rein itself in with humility by not trying to make policy judgment pronouncements in order to allow the stakeholders to have that space to discuss. Another model, Daniel Kemmes, who used to be at, I think it was Montana State's Center for the American West, described a model called the collaboration model for natural resources planning. In this model, what we start out with is not what does the science know, but rather what local knowledge do the stakeholders have, in particular long-term residents of the particular region where the natural resources that are being addressed would say. So you start there with local knowledge. You don't start with science. Then those stakeholders get together and they have a discussion as to what is it that they don't know, but that they need to know in order to properly manage the resources that are involved. And it's only those questions that they go to the scientists for. They commission the researcher whatever is needed to answer the questions that are not yet understood. And that's what the role of the scientist is. It turns out that this particular model, the result of it, is that, first of all, it's built on common ground among people who have different positions. And it also turns science from being this sort of hired guns approach where differing sides each hire their particular experts and they come in and you duke it out within a court setting. Instead of having that, the role of science is healthier because it's much more limited. Another model that I want to describe isn't so much natural resources planning, but I think that there's a lot of things that come from it. And it's the model that the Colossian Forum has pioneered. This particular ministry understands conflicts in churches as opportunities for spiritual formation. And it also, this ministry has this commitment that the fundamentals of faith and the common disciplines that we practice are strong enough for us to lean on in the midst of conflict. And so they've produced curriculum and this whole training regimen to try and help churches who are undergoing conflicts about cultural issues to be able to be essentially trained up to have dialogue with one another so that the disparate groups within the church are able to share. Right now there are two areas that they have curriculum that covers. One is origins, the other is human sexuality. There's others that they're working on, and part of the reason why I know about this group is because I've been in conversation with them about doing something for environmental ethics. The result of this particular model, then, is that Christ is glorified and love is shown, even in the midst of disagreement. And even if at the end the various parties need to part, that at the same time Christ is honored in that entire process. So my conclusion, I would argue that environmental conflict can yield compromise and dialogue. And what are some suggestions, then, based on the things that I've said, that I would suggest and that I would make with regards to making this more likely? First, I would suggest that we look for prudential elements within whatever the environmental problem is, whether it's a global one, like in global warming, or whether it's a local one, whether in terms of like just our cities and towns. Secondly, to try to pivot away from the science and towards the value propositions, the value assumptions that are underlying a lot of the and driving conflict. Third, to choose models that will help support engagement as opposed to models that will tend towards an adversarial kind of a meeting of the minds. And I would suggest that the result of all this is more robust, flexible, locally tuned, and broadly supported responses. I want to end with a shameless commercial. And so in 2016, I published a book with Pickwick Publications called The Nature of Environmental Stewardship. This was my attempt to try and come up with or outline some sort of taxonomy that covered worldviews, ethical theories, politics, economics, science epistemology, and science policy studies to be able to analyze what is it that we all bring to the table in terms of our assumptions that lead us to make certain conclusions with regards to the what kind of policies we favor to take care of the environment. And so I just offer that as a possible resource to help analyze creation care to support compromise and dialogue. And with that, I'll take any questions.
Our advertising rates are quite reasonable.
Thanks.
Paul.
Could you comment on the UN protocol 2015 in Paris when all the countries decided to cut back in their carbon dioxide emissions, and how how that played out, and give that as an example about maybe that. So could you apply that? You gave other examples, but
right. In terms of the details of that particular of the negotiations that happened within that, I don't have anything more to say outside of what, you know, because I didn't like really look into it, and so I just the sort of public media sort of descriptions. I think I will say that just the whole general, I think, IPCC process with regards to climate change, that there have been a number of missed opportunities and in terms of how it's been constructed. I think the role of science within the IPCC system is actually avoided a number of the lessons that came from the science policy literature and put science in a role that that helped to scientize the global warming discussion. And I think that's, you know, that has made it more difficult to actually have the value conversations that are really the important ones. So I think that's one thing that I would say has been true about the entire process with regards to that issue. I also think that the IPCC process has sort of missed an opportunity early on to think more broadly outside of mitigation and to also consider adaptation and other responses, even if those particular responses, you know, had smaller versus larger roles. I think that by channeling the discussion in a very narrow way decades ago, it really sort of postponed the opportunity to build broader support for responses that now it's kind of like it's harder to do. So that those would be two general comments I'd make about that. Yeah,
Paul.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Here's a practical test case. Our county council, county government, considering the global warming situation, they have a proposal to provide an air conditioner for all the low-income people in the county.
Okay.
Of course, that has a carbon impact.
Right.
All right, so what should I say in a three-minute testimony?
Johnny, can you repeat the question?
Yeah, sure. The question is there's a proposal for in the county, local county government, to provide air conditioners for folks, low income folks, to deal with the issues of global warming. And what would one say in a 3-minute testimony to help with that discussion? That's a great question. I guess the initial thought I have is. Would be to say that if this is a proposal, you want to do something, you want to come up with a proposal to address this particular issue, I'd say, what's the working group that you have? You know, have you gone and talked to the stakeholders that are involved, to the people who the low income people that you want to provide these for, the folks who will supply it, you know, other representatives from your tax base who will will be the people who will be contributing to this. I think that would, that'd be the first place that I would start from. And that includes, those stakeholders also include those who are concerned with regards to carbon footprint. Is there perhaps a more general policy that the county has already adopted with regards to climate change or with regards to environmental issues in general? How does that fit in with that? I think all those stakeholders who are plugged into that plan, if you bring those folks together, that's a really... a good place to start.
May I make a suggestion here? That definitely support the air conditioner. I mean, you don't want to say because of climate change, those who can't afford it shouldn't have air conditioning. But for everyone you put in enough solar panels in the town too. So you know.
There's a lot of ways to think creatively. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thanks for your talk. I think it's really helpful. talk about solutions. I'm wondering about how the nature of global problems like climate change differs in our approach and solution from a regional problem like these natural resources.
Right. So the question was, is how do global problems differ from more local problems like natural resources planning? I mean, certainly the number of actors that have to be coordinated or that, you know, have to bring to the table increases. And, you know, there's also sort of the effects of actions in one location are felt in places that have no connection of place. Those I think would be sort of two differences. But I think from the standpoint of actually getting to solutions, that, you know, there was a, I think it was Abby, had given a talk with regards to the idea of sense of place. And when addressing global issues and global problems, I think that they are similar to local problems, in that if we don't connect that somehow to a sense of place, that is sort of very difficult to for us as human beings to be able to grasp the what's going on. I don't think sort of a dry analysis will be enough to be able to not only get to a good solution, but I think to get to a good solution as a community, to be able to, that sort of collaborativeness is really critical. And you can't grow that if it's all you have is abstract thought. At least, I mean, that would be my thinking. So,
okay. Yes.
Can you give your opinion on why you think there was faster political action on the ozone problem than what we're seeing on climate change?
Thank you. So the question is why was there faster action on ozone hole rather than on climate change? So I think part of the reasons were for the reasons that I described in the work by Sarowitz and Pilkey. I think the structure of the way that the policymaking incorporated science and addressed things enabled stakeholders who would be in conflict to have that conflict diffused. And that this was built into the policy response. Whether it was intentional and stuff, I don't know enough of the history to be able to say. But the result was that that was diffused. Okay, so that's, I think, one reason. But I do think a second reason is, and, you know, I think it's very fair to say that these are not commensurate problems. Even though CFCs are very useful, they are nowhere near as critical to the global economy as fossil fuels. And the impact from an economic standpoint is you know, totally, totally different between CFCs as well as versus CO2. And then also, the CFC problem is relatively localized, at least as far as human impact goes. Largest impacts are at polar regions, and while, you know, things can eventually spread, that's there are various sort of meteorological, climatological reasons for why the ozone concentration is more precipitous within those areas. So there's also locality behind it. And so I think that makes the experience with regards to CO2 to be different than with CFCs.
Hmm? Yeah, I just wonder, it seems like there's more of a tendency these days for people to be, to distrust science. So mm-hmm. how we deal with that aspect, that people don't actually mm-hmm. trust the science that's being funded
right.
into these processes.
Right. Well, I think one of the reasons that people don't trust science is as much, I mean, there's obviously a whole bunch of things, and so I don't want to sound like I'm just like focusing on one, but I am just focusing on one, right? But I recognize this is a limited answer, but I do think one of the reasons is that a lot of our debates, certainly environmental ones, but other ones too, have become scientized. And this is language that Sarowitz uses, that we've converted debates that really need to be value debates, we've converted them into science debates, and there's this sort of putative argument of, you know, I've got my expert that says this, and the other side says, I've got my expert that says this. And so I don't think, given that environment, it's really that strange that the public would look at this and just say, well, science is just sort of another cudgel that you use to batter whoever it is that you disagree with. And in that kind of role, you know, I think a lot of the things that make science a really powerful and useful tool, you essentially strip them away in sort of the name of a short-term gain of having scientific authority on your side. So I think that's one reason for, you know, for science having that, you know, having less authority. There are, of course, many others, postmodernism, blah, blah, blah. So,
yeah. Okay, I think that reaches our time here, and thank you very much.